This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fazl Shaikh is an award-winning photojournalist. He was born in New York City in 1965 and studied at Princeton University. Shaikh was named after his grandfather, who grew up in Pakistan, then emigrated to Kenya in the early days of the century. In 1996, Shaikh went to Pakistan to learn more about his grandfather, hoping in the process to learn more about himself. He did, but along the way, he also learned that hundreds of thousands of refugees from Afghanistan had fled across the border to Pakistan, fleeing Afghanistan's two recent wars, the war against the Soviets and the subsequent civil war, which led to the Muslim fundamentalist Taliban government. Fazl Shaikh's new book, The Victor Weeps, documents the lives of Afghan refugees through photos and oral histories. Nearly all the members in this refugee community have tragic stories to tell.
It's a place where, for two decades, they've been in the midst of war, and so you have, you know, generations of children, 19 years old, and all they have known is the warring. And many of the people living in these villages of exile were Mujahideen freedom fighters in the late 70s and early 80s.
Fighting against the Soviets.
Exactly. And for me, in fact, it was very curious to be in the villages because they greeted me as what they saw as a fellow Muslim, but also as an American. And they would often come to me and ask what had happened to America's determination and willingness to help them in their plight. Of course, in the early 80s, we were heavily supporting the Mujahideen resistance. And when the Russians, or I should say the Soviets, withdrew from Afghanistan, they were, in their minds, completely abandoned. All of the support, the money that was funneled through that region was completely withdrawn. And now they've lived there since that time for 10 years. And they still haven't really come to terms with that sense of abandon. They believed that we were truly there because we were their brothers, because we believed in their fight, in the jihad, and that it was altruistic, that we wanted to help their people.
Just about everyone in the refugee camp where you were had people, loved ones, who were killed during either the war with the Soviets or the fighting with the Taliban. You photographed several of these people holding pictures of lost loved ones, of dead loved ones. What made you decide to photograph the photographs?
What I was curious about there is that for 2 years, you know, I had asked the people about the nature of the fighting and the loss and the jihad. And what became clear to me was that the loss of the life goes beyond just that person offered, say, to the jihad, that the loss carries on to those loved ones left behind. And in the book, the people are often bearing the picture to me or to us as the viewers to show us that there is still that link, that the loss of that person is still carried within the community.
You must have also thought a lot about the place of the photographs in the lives of survivors because you're a photographer. This is the work that you do.
Yeah. In some regard, I'm a bit distrustful of the photograph because though it spurs the imagination onward, I'm not so sure how close it gets to a factual rendering of a place or a person. And so I found that I needed to use the text or their voices to round out what the photographic image was unable to convey. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I often think about that too. You know, when you have photographs that you really cherish, but you realize it's just it's one frozen moment in time. Even when you know the person well, it's one moment, so you don't want to invest too much in just that photograph and what it captures.
Yeah, and it does some things it does so well that on occasion when you'll read the history or you'll hear the history of what happened to the person in the photograph, it changes how you see it.
Right,
you know, you see it at first and you have an idea of what that person's life is like, and in a way you meld it with your own understanding of the world. And then when you hear the word spoken or in this case, you know, the written testimonial, somehow your understanding of the picture changes. And I think that's fantastic.
You went to Afghanistan in 1996 and 97. During your second trip to Afghanistan, the Taliban, the Muslim fundamentalists, had already taken over much of the country. So you had to pass through Taliban checkpoints. And it sounds like you tried to dress as if you were from Afghanistan. What did you do to help make it easier to pass through the checkpoints?
Well, actually, my features are such that I look rather Afghan. But towards the end of my stay in Pakistan and working in those Afghan communities, I decided, as you mentioned, to make a second trip from Peshawar up towards Kabul. And in that period, photography had been outlawed, and to be caught photographing, you could be beaten or perhaps imprisoned. And so I decided to travel as an Afghan without a camera, just to see how in a way the city had changed in the interim. And so I traveled with my interpreter dressed in a silwar and an Afghan turban by bus from Peshawar up to Kabul. I, in fact, found at that period, that was nearly a year ago now, what the Taliban had done was they had brought great security to the regions. Arms had been removed, and there wasn't generally the threat in the remote areas that I had felt in previous times. Of course, the nature of their inability to have a policy, or the extreme repression that they had brought to the women and the communities of, say, Kabul, still continue to this day.
You mentioned that the Taliban had outlawed photography. Why?
They saw it as creating an idol, that which would compete with the respect only to be accorded to Allah.
You actually went to a photography studio in Afghanistan, a studio that had been shut down by the Taliban, and you met the photographer who ran the studio. What was his reaction to what had happened to photography?
Yeah, that was quite a curious evening. We had just arrived in Jalalabad, which is a city about halfway towards Kabul, and we were walking through the streets in the evening, and all of the photo studios had been closed, and the frames were laying in tatters on the ground within the windows. But we passed one studio where there was a light inside, and there was a man sitting there. And we entered through the doorway and were greeted by him and began to talk and related why I was there and what I was interested in. And he spoke about this time as though it was just another kind of pause in the cycle, that his business would return when the Taliban moved on, and that he was weathering that rather trying time in their history. And towards the end of our stay and our conversation, he allowed me to have some negatives of photographs that he had made in the community. I thought his willingness to give me those photographs was in some regard an offering of opposition to this kind of repression that was being leveled by the Taliban.
And you reprint some of those photographs in your book.
Yes.
Now, you told the owner of this photography studio that you were hoping to do a book that would bring the photographs and the voices of the people of Afghanistan to the rest of the world. And what was his response to that?
Well, it was a curious response. Yeah, he laughed and he said, well, should you bring such a book back to Afghanistan, it would be burned and you would be beaten, which, of course, is completely true. But I think, in the main, those who I talked to were really sympathetic. They were interested in having a broader vision of their community brought to the world. And they were hoping, in a way, and this is for me the very sad part, they were hoping in a way that kind of communication would bring some sort of tangible solution to their situation. For me, both in Africa and Afghanistan, that's always been a very difficult thing to confront, is the extraordinary hope that your presence will bring profound change. And, you know, for my part, I don't know exactly what my work or that kind of work does for a place like Afghanistan or Africa. You hope that in some regard it has a positive effect in the world, but you can't measure it in sort of any tangible sense.
My guest is photojournalist Fuzzle Shaikh. His new book is called The Victor Weeps. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photojournalist Fuzzle Shaikh. His new book documents the lives of refugees from Afghanistan who fled to Pakistan. Shaikh first went to Pakistan to learn about his grandfather who was from there. You had a couple of motivations in going to Pakistan and then Afghanistan. One was to learn more about your grandfather and his Muslim religion, and the other was a more kind of political motive to document what was happening to the people of Afghanistan who were living in the refugee camps. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about what you learned about Islam and the religion of your grandfather. It seems that on this trip you were exposed to some of the most beautiful and some of the most extreme and restrictive aspects of Islam. Let's start with the most beautiful. What were some of the things that you found most moving about the ways in which you saw the Muslim religion practiced by the people who you felt closest to?
There were some extraordinary moments, which generally I was invited to by virtue of having this man named Abdul Sattar, who was my companion and interpreter. And sometimes we would have a long day. For instance, one time we traveled over the mountains to Chitral in northern Pakistan, and it was the beginning of winter and was quite cold in the region, and I was sitting in the room just huddling under some blankets, and I could hear from out in the courtyard the voice of the call to prayer, of the prayer being recited. And I peered through the window into the darkness, and there was Abdul Sattar. He's an older gentleman in his late 40s, well respected within the community, and he was leading the group in prayer. There were perhaps 15 men standing together. And what for me was so striking about it was, as he intoned the prayer and bent forward and then to his knees, the people behind him then following, was that all of the people of the area in which we were staying had now a kind of equality. The boy who had been cleaning the toilets stood beside the owner of the guest house, and all of them at once seemed bound in this kind of, shall we say, meditation or reverie, which I found very beautiful.
What did you find disturbing in how the more extreme followers of Islam practiced the faith?
I think perhaps the most upsetting thing is something that I have never fully come to understand is the somewhat aggressive and violent nature of the religion, or of the way, shall we say, that it's interpreted. I never fully understood the nature of killing the murderer, or even, shall we say, more broadly, of the jihad. I was there at a time when a murderer was caught who had been robbing the home of a family and killed the wife and the children. The father had not been at home. And he was brought to a public square. And the father was then able to confront the murderer, armed with an AK-47, and was given the choice of forgiving the murderer or taking the man's life. And the father chose for the latter and shot the man many times. And I often had conversations. It's in fact difficult at times to have a very contentious conversation about the nature of the edicts of the Taliban or even about Islam, but had to admit that I never really understood this admonition, that in some degree I always felt that the encouraging or allowing the husband, say in this instance, to kill the murderer, in some degree, didn't it bring some of that hurt or some of that negative, what should we say, a negative energy onto him? Was he not, in essence, tainted by his own act?
You became very close to your interpreter, and he was your interpreter and companion for 2 years, and he probably led you through some pretty risky situations and helped keep you safe and oriented throughout the journeys. Yet he lives in such a different world than you do, and I was wondering if it was very difficult for you to understand the world from his point of view. I mean, for instance, he has three wives.
Mm-hmm.
The youngest, I think, is about 14.
Yes, he was planning to marry the youngest. He was at the time 44, and he was going to marry his third wife, who was just 14 at the time.
So that's an idea that's very kind of common to him and very, I'm sure, alien to you. Was it hard for you to kind of fathom that type of life being lived by somebody who you had become very close to?
I think we were fortunate in that we related to one another very well on a kind of human personal level. And so that was a springboard from which we could explore our differences. He was open to discussing his society and his religion, and he was very curious about the way that I had been raised and respectful of my place, even though I wasn't engaging the religion in the way that he did. And so this was in a way a kind of fantastic entree to the community, that though even Abdul Sattar, in the way that he spoke about the jihad, I had to be honest with him that we came at times to the position where we just couldn't understand each other. We, in this notion of the responsibility to kill the murderer because we love the people and want to protect them, that we must kill the murderer, was something, perhaps because of my privileged upbringing, that I could never understand. But I resisted judging it and judging him for his stance, in a way.
I just want to ask you a little bit about your approach to taking pictures of the people from Pakistan and Afghanistan. A lot of the photographs in the book that you took are tight close-ups of faces. And I don't know whether it's because you use long exposures, but the faces are just very detailed.
Mm-hmm.
Every wrinkle, every facial detail is kind of fully displayed in black and white, not color.
Mm-hmm.
Would you describe a little bit your approach to taking the portraits that appear in your book about Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think in some regard I was interested in creating a kind of a meditative mood in the images and allowing the kind of landscape of the face to give you the feeling that it was harboring a rather deep history. And the photographs in the early part of the book, made of the Mujahideen elders at night, were just by the light of a gas lamp. And so their features and the strength of their gaze, I think, is in some way accented by the qualities of that rendering. And works well, I think, in concert with their own voices, their own testimonials.
I like what you said about the strength of their gaze. That's something that that you really notice when you look at the photographs. I'm wondering, did you give them any advice? You know, I really hate it when photographers say, okay, give me a smile now. Yeah. Obviously, you're not going to do that with Elder Mujahideen. Smile for the camera.
Not like that.
But did you tell them anything about what you wanted them to do as they posed for you?
No, in fact, I've learned in the last few years that images that I was able to envision or imagine before I made them were often not nearly as compelling as the ones that came from a kind of collaboration. That in a way, how could I presume to create something that was more powerful, more evocative than their own lives, than the way that they knew to carry themselves, to hold themselves, and to look with kind of comfort and clarity towards me? Or I'm not really interested in rendering them in a way that I can premeditate. How could that be nearly as fascinating as what they already know of their own lives? You know, and I think that that is able to ring true in a way that a pose is not.
Fuzzle Shaikh, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Fuzzle Shaikh's new book about Afghan refugees is called The Victor Weeps. This is Fresh Air.